You're listening to Scribble Talk, an SMA exclusive, a sponsored podcast series from our friends at SMA. My name is Bhaskar Sundaram, and I will be sitting down with our SMA colleagues to share their stories, discuss their career, and learn how they are making an impact in the industry. Today's guest is Alan Berman. Alan is Vice President at SMA. He specializes in market analysis, strategy development, and new business creation. Prior to SMA, Alan spent 11 years in strategy consulting at Monitor Group and Deloitte Consulting, focused on growth strategy and innovation. In that role, he led engagements with clients that included senior leaders of Fortune 500 companies, emerging technology-based firms, and the Department of Defense. Those engagements tackled thorny challenges with multi-billion dollar implications. The projects spanned the aerospace, defense, healthcare, automotive, and consumer electronics industries. Prior to consulting, Alan was at Zone Reactor, a technology incubator funded by Draper Fisher Jovestan Venture Capital Network, where he served as entrepreneur in residence. Projects centered on technology commercialization of government-funded R&D and resulted in commercial application of over a dozen patents. Wow. Prior to Zone Reactor, Alan worked as a hard drive and tape drive development engineer and tribologist at Seagate Technology. We'll talk all about it, Alan. Alan received his bachelor's and doctor's degrees in chemical engineering from UCLA and University of California, Santa Barbara, respectively, and earned an MBA from the Anderson School at UCLA. Welcome, Alan, to Scribble Talk. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Alan. Alan, let's go back to the very beginning. Where were you born? And let's talk about your high school and education.
Yeah, born in Los Angeles. I still live in Los Angeles, so it's a tough area to leave because of the weather. I went to high school at Beverly Hills High School and so stayed local.
Got you. And you also completed your bachelor's as well in UCLA. So when was that and why chemical engineering?
Chemical engineering was a bit of a compromise choice for me. Mm. At the time, I was really interested in biotechnology and bioengineering and some of the things that were happening in the 1980s, early 1990s, some of the really exciting innovations within that space. And so that was an area that I was really most interested in. When I started UCLA, they had that major. And then when I left UCLA, they no longer had that major. So it was a matter of finding something else there that would be similar and really suit those interests. And so a lot of the biotechnology activities there got subsumed by the chemical engineering department. And that's where I ended up within chemical engineering.
Got you. And did you progress straight from your bachelor's to master's and PhD, Alan, or did you took a break and went back?
Yeah, straight from bachelor's program to graduate school in chemical engineering at UC Santa Barbara. The path there was not to get a master's, but it was just a PhD program. So from bachelor's to PhD, all within chemical engineering.
Wow. Dr. Alan Berman. That's nice. So after UC is Santa Barbara in chemical engineering, what was the very first job that you took?
Yeah, so my work at UC Santa Barbara was kind of got transformed a little bit. There was a little bit of bioengineering. Some of the research work that I had done had to do with interactions between biological cells, but generally the research was more around interactions between surfaces. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a, surfaces are whenever anything touches something else, you have interactions between surfaces. Some of the work that I had done was really around forces, attractive forces and repulsive forces and friction forces between surfaces. And turns out that that is an area that is at the time was very relevant to the hard drive industry and still quite relevant. So the way hard drives are designed, it's kind of like a record player where you have a head that's reading a disc, and those hard drives, at the time and still now, there was a constant push for more density on the discs. And one of the ways of achieving that is really getting the head closer and closer to the disc The issue is, though, the closer it gets, you end up with bumping and rubbing and friction and wear, and you know, those are not things that you really would want to see within a, a high precision electronic system. And so tribology ended up being very relevant for managing the interactions between the heads and the discs. And then I also, after doing a couple of years at Seagate within disk drives, moved over into tape drives, and similar sorts of issues around the head and the magnetic medium to really understand and control the interfaces between those and, you know, make those systems work better.
Wow. I think people now will who are listening will be wondering, what's a hard drive? What's a tape drive and stuff?
You can... Well, I mean, a lot of that is aging technology. So now most of the storage systems that we have in computers are solid state drives. So
yes,
it's just chips, no moving parts. But there still are hard drives and tape drives used in certain applications. And it's actually still quite a big market.
Totally. Well, what's the tribologist, Alan?
So tribology is, I guess, a study of friction and wear between surfaces. And so the early version of tribology is, or maybe some of the traditional tribologists have been in around engines and the oil industry and things like that, where you have, you know, traditional lubricants protecting surfaces. It has gone, as the world kind of moved towards nanotechnology and MEMS and things like that, some of the emerging technologies where it's things get smaller and get closer together, tribology became a lot more relevant to those sorts of things. And then, you know, just generally it's the interaction between surfaces and it's the friction and wear associated with surfaces moving by each other.
Totally. Well, Alan, that's a good physics lesson, chapter one. You know? I wish my children listened to it at some point and learn what's a surface and what's friction and stuff. I can now at least show off I know something about it. Thank you, Alan. From Seagate, was the next step, was it zone reactor? Was that, how did the transition happen? That looks like a very different.
Yeah, so for my time at Seagate, I decided that I did not want to be working in the lab for my career. So a bit of a life lesson, you know, you have your best laid plans and you do a lot of preparation for it and then decide, this isn't really what I wanted to do. So I decided to leave the engineering world, or kind of the hands-on engineering world, and go back to business school. So I left work and went to UCLA Anderson for my MBA. And so spent a couple of years doing that. And then after my MBA degree, I ended up working at Zone Reactor. That work was really an effort to kind of combine my areas of interest. So clearly I had a lot of interest and passion around technology and engineering, as well as, you know, more of an interest around business and how things work and how the business world works. And so Zone Reactor was a job where I was able to work on technology commercialization. So it was not just around technology development and technology maturation, but it was more around getting interesting novel technologies out of the laboratory and into the marketplace. And you know, people who have been in that space can appreciate that it's not just about getting the technology to work. And in a lot of cases, that's maybe the easy part. And it's certainly not an easy part, but in some cases, the other parts end up being a lot more complicated or challenging associated with funding and creating an entity to actually execute and finding a market and finding customers and developing products and adapting them and, you know, all the different steps associated with, you know, going from the laboratory to the marketplace and having these technologies actually used by end customers and users.
Wow. And do you have any memorable technology commercialized projects that you worked on, Alan? Anything interesting?
Yeah, so technology commercialization is traditionally a pretty challenging space. And there's always a lot of thinking around, are there formulas associated with it? What's the right path for doing it? And if you look at the history, there are actually a lot of, obviously a lot of successes in technology commercialization, but not a whole lot of, repeatable cookie cutter recipes for doing it. There have been a variety of ways that technology commercialization has been successful. A lot of it has been based on circumstances and happenstance and, the sheer drive of the entrepreneur in making things happen. The projects that we had done were, we were looking for a more formulaic way of doing it. And, I think one of the lessons in working in that space is that there is no one monolithic way of achieving successful technology commercialization on a repeatable basis. We were able to do a fair bit of work around licensing some of the IP from intellectual properties from defense companies. So companies that had developed technologies for military applications recognized that, hey, wait a minute, some of this technology actually might be useful in the commercial world. And so we were able to do some work around understanding market applications for certain technologies. One area of technologies was around carbon fiber composites and new ways of designing and building composites for structural applications. And some of those we were able to license to companies that have been able to put them in practice. So, some successes, some interesting examples, but, not really the kind of breakout success that we were expecting or hoping for in terms of being able to create startups that would, turn into billion-dollar entities based on some of these laboratory technologies.
That's fascinating. I think how we kind of started as a researcher, then moved on into incubate, see other companies grow within the sector. And how long were you there, Alan? And when did you join Deloitte? Or was it Monitor? Next.
Yeah, so I spent probably a couple of years at Zone Reactor doing technology commercialization. In the course of doing that, we ended up in a collaboration with Monitor Group in that space. And through a kind of a strange set of circumstances, I ended up transitioning over from Zone Reactor into Monitor, doing partially technology commercialization, but then I started doing some regular Monitor Group consulting work. So business strategy consulting, management consulting work. And I found that I really enjoyed it and had some aptitude there. And so ended up kind of going mainstream regular consulting within Monitor Group. And I ended up doing that, and Monitor was acquired by Deloitte. So between the two companies, probably 11, 12 years or so.
Wow. So from technology incubation to strategy consulting, how did you adapt yourself in those things? And do you have any memorable projects when you were at Monitor?
Yeah, I think the adaptation was more about I don't think it was a total shift from one area to another. I think there was a lot of overlap between in the kind of work that was being done, maybe a little bit different in terms of expected outcome and the process that you undertake. But, in both cases, there's a lot of work around market analysis and developing business cases and financial analysis and kind of thinking strategically, understanding what's the product? What are the competitors? Who are the competitors? How are they thinking? And how do you position yourself for growth or for market entry or competitive success or whatever it might be? And I think that was kind of a common theme across them. In terms of kind of memorable projects, I would say that one of the big areas where we had done a number of projects was around GPS, so satellite positioning, and more broadly, the position, navigation, and timing area. We started off by doing some work for the U.S. government and ended up doing work not just for the government, but also for a couple of different private companies that were interested in the space. And just really fascinating how that whole sector is has evolved, and you know, the level of interest, the level of diversity of technologies that are out there in terms of supplying solutions, as well as the diversity of the users for those sorts of systems. So, you know, when we typically think about GPS, we think about the navigation, you know, Google Maps on your phone, helping you get from your house to a store or something like that. Yes, that uses GPS, but there are so many other uses of GPS that go beyond personal navigation across a number of different industries. One of the big overlooked areas is around the timing component of GPS. So GPS doesn't only provide positioning information, but it also provides highly accurate timing information that ends up being used for synchronizing networks and telecommunications and in financial systems and things like that, where it really becomes a critical enabler of a lot of the fundamental systems that we use around cellular communications, you know, I mean, regular telephony, internet communications, as well as financial systems. You know, I've heard anecdotally, and I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, that if GPS went out, none of our ATMs would work because of a variety of reasons associated with that as well. So it was interesting to understand the kind of the evolution of GPS going from a military system with military applications to really primarily commercial civilian applications, and understanding the variety of the users, the diversity of the users, as well as the diversity of needs among those users. And based on that, I think that's caused a lot of complications as well as opportunities around the position, navigation, and timing industry, and GPS in particular, in terms of how new services are rolled out and how, you know, different users' needs are met. And so, you know, I think that that's really been one of the most memorable areas of work that I've had, just because of the complexity of the ecosystem, both on the user side as well as the technology side and the different stakeholders involved.
Wow. Looks like you thoroughly enjoy some sort of scientific technological element in anything you do.
Yeah, really, that's been, you know, when I, after I got my PhD and then I got my MBA, people were saying, oh, so you're not going to do engineering anymore. You're just going on the business side. It's like, I don't think it's that simplistic. I think that anybody who tries to take a narrow view of anything ends up missing a lot of the story. That's to say that if you just have a view of the technology and the technical aspects of something, you really miss out on the variety of other factors that will make something successful or not successful, or work or not work, based on markets and competitors and industry structure and things like that. By the same token, if you just try to take a, you know, quote unquote businessy view around things, you really miss out on a lot of the nuances associated with technologies and what they're capable of doing and offering and where the limitations are that really are the critical factors for how things are going to evolve over time and really understanding how markets are going to work. And so I think that, and this is kind of my general philosophy, that you really have to have this broader view around not just one aspect of it, but really the full picture to be able to understand your situation and understand how things are going to unfold and understand where you might be able to apply certain efforts or certain lever points to be able to make things happen in terms of being more competitive, in terms of product introduction, in terms of market adoption, in terms of, you know, winning in a marketplace or whatever it might be.
Totally true, Warren, totally true. After Monitor, when did you join SMN or SMNA then?
Right. So yeah, Monitor was acquired by Deloitte. And so spent a couple of years there. And then In conversations with AJ Patel, who I had worked with closely at Monitor Group, actually from the very beginning, when I transitioned from Zone Reactor over into Monitor, he was already at SMA for, I guess, a year or two, and he invited me over to come work on some stuff, and that was really interesting, and I ended up joining probably, I think it was early 2015, so coming up on 6 years now.
Wow. And was your specialism the same of what you were using at Monitor, market analysis, strategy, and new business creation inside?
Yeah, I've had a couple of different roles within SMA. Some of them have been internal activities. So as you know, SMA has been developing the talent on demand system, TOD, and, really as a differentiated approach towards matching talent with opportunities, with project needs. And so some of the work that I have done has been internally focused around either design or development of certain aspects of the TOD system. And part of it has been really around understanding the competitive environment and how TOD fits in with the broader ecosystem within the professional staffing space. And then a lot of my work has really been externally focused. So client serving, strategy, competitive strategy, market analysis, consulting work for our clients.
Perfect. And why do you think, because market analysis, strategy, new business comes before capture and proposals, right, Alan? And why do you think companies need to invest on that sort of elements?
Yeah, I think it's been a bit of an evolution within the capture and proposal world. I think early on, there was a belief that, okay, an RFP comes out, a request for proposal comes out, and you just go out and answer those questions or, describe what you have as best as you can and hope that you win. And then, with I guess experience and some hard-learned lessons, people have come to understand that you really can't just wait for an RFP to come out. You have to be doing work prior to the RFP to really understand the circumstances and prepare for it, as well as to shape the environment. To the extent that bidders can really have an RFP reflect what they have to offer, that's going to position them much better to win. And so there are a number of shaping activities associated with that. Similarly, to the extent that you can understand what competitors are going to be doing or likely to be doing, and that will give insights into how you should position yourself to differentiate and win these proposals. And so there's clearly been an understanding that more upstream work or more earlier stage work ends up being very effective in increasing your competitiveness in competitive RFPs. That has reached the point where, it's not just around, shaping, but it also ends up being much earlier stage in terms of developing technologies and solutions and even structuring businesses to be able to better pursue and win a number of different sorts of competitions out there. So the way I came from it is even at Monitor Group, we had gotten involved in specific competitions where it wasn't just around understanding markets and understanding the typical work at Monitor Group was around competitive strategy and growth strategy. So a lot of that has to do with understanding markets and then deciding, you're going to decide where to play. And then within those, how are you going to win? So we describe a whole strategy cascade where you start off with goals and aspirations. And then based on those, you make decisions around where to play. And then based on those, you come up with decisions around how are you going to win in those areas where you've decided to play. And then further down on that cascade is what sorts of things do you need to do or what sorts of systems do you have to have in place to enable that how to win strategy or your differentiation within the market. That work around, kind of the general growth strategy and competitive strategy really was made a lot more pointed with work around very specific competitions that some of our clients were going after. And we found that using similar, general strategy consulting tactics and techniques and frameworks really helped to understand the nature of the competition, as well as the best ways of approaching the competition to both shape it and then differentiate and ultimately win. And so some of the things that we had done around stakeholder analysis, competitor analysis, industry structure analysis, that are typical sorts of things that you do within strategy consulting to decide to develop growth strategies, ended up being very relevant to competitive strategies, even on specific programs. And we applied those and ended up with some pretty good successes. And, we've continued that at SMA, really offering those services to our clients. And I think it takes a little bit of sophistication on the client side to really understand the value of some of this upfront work, just because it is a pretty significant investment. But for the size of programs that some of our clients are going after, these multi-billion dollar programs, it really does warrant earlier and pretty significant upfront investment in really understanding the circumstances, trying to shape that landscape, and then developing very differentiated strategies to win those.
Wow, that's very comprehensive. Thank you, Alan. And does SMA has any kind of interesting strategy market analysis tools that we use to address these, Alan?
Yeah, so I talked a little bit about the strategy cascade in terms of the goals and aspirations and where to play and how to win and actions and initiatives and resources to support those. We use that as a kind of the foundational framework for thinking about a particular situation. As we get into developing competitive strategies, one of the things that we use is something called making winning choices, where what we'll do is we'll come up with a candidate strategy. And the idea with making winning choices is you kind of work backwards. You come up with a solution or a candidate solution, doesn't have to be the right one, and you test it and say, okay, is this good or is this not good? And why is it good or not good? And then that gives you insights into refining it. So instead of trying to kind of organically develop a strategy going forward, it's a lot of times easier to just kind of come up with a strategy. And a lot of times our clients have been working on certain platforms or circumstances or programs for quite a while. And so they kind of have inherent in their thinking, the answer. And sometimes the answer that they have in their head is right. Sometimes it's got issues associated with it. So the making winning choices allows us to start with the end state and then go backwards and test it. And we ask the question, what must be true for this strategy, for this approach to be successful? And the what must be true sorts of questions end up being across a number of different dimensions. So what has to be true about the company capabilities? What has to be true about competitors? What has to be true about the customer and the customer community? And on the customer side, I think it's important to emphasize that it's really a customer community, that it's not just the end user that's the customer. You have the contracting or the program office. You have typically stakeholders at more senior levels within the acquisition community, as well as within the leadership. If you think about Department of Defense, you have services versus Office of Secretary of Defense. There are financial components. There's even going beyond, sometimes you have congressional stakeholders that end up being interested, or other third-party non-governmental groups that are interested and end up being influential stakeholders, either think tanks or in the case of military healthcare, there are a lot of advocacy groups for the beneficiaries of military healthcare that end up being influential. And so really understanding the full customer environment ends up being important. And so, you know, going back to the making winning choices and what must be true, you ask these questions around what must be true across a number of different stakeholders for this strategy to be a successful strategy. And then what we'll do is we'll essentially define criteria associated with the strategy being successful. And then we'll go off and test those criteria. We'll do research or analysis or, or on the technology side, maybe it's actual technical analysis to understand performance in certain circumstances. And does this satisfy the criteria around meeting the technical needs of the customer? Around stakeholders within the customer community, we'll try to understand, well, what are their real drivers? You know, customers are always looking for better, faster, cheaper. But usually it's a lot more nuanced than that. So maybe in some circumstances, budget ends up being the real big driver for decisions. In other circumstances, there might be a particular operational need that really must be met. In other cases, the customer might be coming off of circumstances where the program has just experienced a lot of delays and problems, and they're just looking for a low-risk solution. And so a lot of times the customer circumstances will point you towards certain sorts of things that they're looking for much more importantly than other areas. And then on the competitor side, we'll do a lot of work really understanding where the competitors are, and you know, the what must be true questions would be what must be true around the competitors' offerings to say that the offering or the solution that we're, or the strategy that we're thinking about for our client, what would have to be true around what the competitors are offering or what the competitors are doing and thinking that would make our client's solution successful? So that's to say, if we're thinking about a low-cost strategy, well, then you'd have to believe that the competitors are not really investing in cost, and they're really focusing on other aspects of their offering. Or if our differentiation is around a certain performance characteristic, then you'd have to believe that the competitors wouldn't be able to match that, or that our performance characteristic would be far and away differentiated from the competitors. So in asking those questions around what must be true, we end up with a pretty good sense of the likelihood of success of a specific strategy. And based on those criteria, we might end up adjusting that strategy and refining it a little bit, or just recognizing, hey, there's too much risk, or there are too many criteria that are just not being met by the strategy, and starting over with a new and different strategy for winning a specific program. And that making winning choices approach has really been really valuable to our clients from a couple of standpoints. From one standpoint, it has given them a lot more confidence in a specific strategy to pursue, recognizing that there is just a lot of uncertainty out there in any competition. You don't really, really know what the customer is thinking or what their underlying beliefs are. I mean, you'll look into it and you'll try to understand it the best you can, but you never really, really know. You never really know what the competitors are doing. And in a lot of cases, there are a lot of uncertainties internally as well, in terms of company capabilities or technology maturity or things like that. And so given all the uncertainties that are out there, to the extent that you can really characterize the relative strength of a given strategy and really have a good handle on what the uncertainties are, or maybe some of the conditions that must be true that you're not totally certain about, gives clients a lot of confidence in a specific direction, as well as gives a bit of an action roadmap around, okay, well, what sorts of things do I need to be working on to increase the strength of this strategy? And it might be around R&D investments to mature certain technologies. It might be around investments in facilities to be able to reduce risk of, you know, production ramps. It could be around developing IT systems to streamline certain processes, or it could be around customer shaping to, you know, really have the customer understand why the way that we're differentiating ourselves in this competition is important to the customer, and why the customer should weigh this, you know, be it around cost, be it around performance, be it around risk, or whatever our differentiating aspect of our offering is. So that's really one of the key tools that we use in these sorts of circumstances that has really been effective in our work. We do a lot of other work around competitive assessment and price to win analyses. We do a lot of work around within that, really understanding customers, really understanding competitors. So, you know, a variety of tools associated with it, but I think one of those all really feed into this making winning choices for helping our clients make decisions around strategy and how they're going to compete.
Totally, Alan. Looks like making winning choices is a very interesting tool, and for a bid and proposal consulting firm to have strategy and market development offering part of it is very unique in the industry. And I mean, SMA is highly differentiated in that aspect. So that's good. Thank you, Alan. Thanks for that. Alan, we talked about your early life career, and we also talked about SMA and market development strategy. Now let's loosen up and talk more about you, Alan. So tell us the three things not many people know about you.
I don't know. I don't feel like I'm that closed off, but I don't know what people wouldn't know about me. I'm pretty open about some of my interests around cycling and fitness and things like that. I don't know. I don't think there are three things.
That's good. What are your hobbies and interests, Alan?
Yeah. So I like bike riding a lot. So ever since I was a kid, I loved the freedom associated with riding my bike. And, you know, through high school and beyond, I just got more and more serious about biking and racing. And that's really been my channel for sanity, especially during COVID, to be able to get out and get fresh air and you know, get heart pumping.
Totally. And you also mentioned that you're also very good in doing do-it-yourself work at home. I thought normally people do furniture and stuff, but in your case, it's more hardware, plumbing, electrical and stuff, Alan. Do you have any plans to come to London?
Yeah, I don't know about working in 220 volt, but... yeah, I think this is just, these are things that I picked up over time that, you know, not terribly difficult, but, you know, useful. And so I've been able to do some projects around the house, like installing lights in the ceilings and fixing plumbing issues around the house. And anybody who's a homeowner knows that there are always things that are going on. My house is, I think, coming up on 100 years old. So it's got its issues, and so there are always new challenges and adventures associated with this one, and some recurring ones. For example, we have a toilet from the 1920s that has a very non-conventional plumbing structure on the inside that ends up being an ongoing challenge that, I don't know, it's a bit of a love-hate relationship, but... It keeps me busy on a periodic basis.
It's amazing. I think looking back at your transition, you know, chemical engineer, PhD in chemical engineering, moved on to do what we call tribology and other stuff, went on to do incubation, market development strategy, but inside you do plumbing, electrical and hardware. You are a man of talents.
So the hands-on stuff allows me to put my engineering education to work. I think a lot of the engineering education is really around problem solving, and anything around the house, you just break down the problem into what is it, why doesn't it work, what do you need to do to fix it, and just that methodical approach. I think it's all very related.
I think that's the typical engineering mind of problem solving. Give me a challenge, I'll solve the problem. That's brilliant. Thank you, Alan. So, Alan, you mentioned about your bike riding. Do you have any favorite or interesting memories of bike riding? Any memories?
In school, I competed, and so a lot of great memories. Competing on the UCLA and then the UC Santa Barbara cycling teams, and traveling around the state for these intercollegiate competitions. And then just a lot of really epic rides around Southern California. In Santa Barbara, there's a hill called Gibraltar, or there's a mountain called Gibraltar that is just a great climb that I think a lot of professional cyclists, when they're in the off season, will train in Santa Barbara, and that's one of the favorite rides up there. I ended up doing it with some friends late at night under a full moon without lights. And that was really one of the epic rides that really stands out in my mind. Just really being able to be out there, with nature and in different circumstances, getting away from cars. It's just fantastic.
Totally. Sounds amazing to me. And I can't even drive during daylight properly, Alan, let alone do it in the night. But
I'm not sure how safe it was because, the roads were still open, but it was really fantastic.
That's good. That's good, Alan. And do you have a favorite place that you travel to that you really like?
Yeah, our family has done a lot of family trips to Mammoth. Mammoth is a ski resort in central northern California. We typically go there in the summer, though. And in the summer, it's just beautiful. It's kind of an alpine resort area with bike riding and hiking and lakes and fishing and all sorts of great stuff like that. It's just a great family retreat, and we've done that trip with a couple of other families that has really been a lot of formative memories traveling there.
Sounds amazing. What trait do you like the most about yourself?
I guess being methodical and analytic and trying to be logical around whatever the circumstances might be, solving a problem, thinking through an issue, just that structured, methodical, I guess maybe nuanced understanding and not really jumping to black and white conclusions, but really being able to, or trying to understand the various aspects of the situation and forming opinions and making decisions based on that.
Got you. Do you ever talk to yourself? If so, what do you say?
Do I talk to myself? I don't think I do. I guess my kids would disagree. I'm often in the car. I'll remember something that I forgot to bring it, and then I tell myself. But I don't really think of that as talking to myself. There's a lot of, I guess, maybe solitude on a bike ride where I'll think. A lot of that is thinking about short-term plans, long-term plans, trying to think through issues. So not really talking to myself, but, some of those circumstances, I have opportunities to just kind of think and think through things.
God, yeah, that's nice. What will you do if you have a time machine?
Well, I don't know. I feel like I've seen too many movies where time travel ends up messing everything up. So I think I'd probably be afraid to use it. I don't know. I'm not that wistful around the past, or and you know, not that curious around the future. That's to say that, you know, I try to live in the present and, you know, enjoy or you know, not worry too much about the future. And my attitude is just kind of work hard and do the right things, and things kind of play out relatively well. You don't really know what's going to happen. And, you know, I guess I don't know how well, I don't know how good my plans would be, that, you know, if I could go into the future and like tweak things, or go into the past and tweak things to make them just so, I don't know if things would actually be better. So
yes.
I don't know. I don't think I would use it.
Yes, I think that's a very rational decision, Alan. I think I expected that response from you. So if a genie granted you 3 wishes, what wish would you ask the genie for?
I don't know. I feel like there are always things that could be better. But I feel like I've been pretty fortunate with my family, career. Again, I don't know if they're I feel like it's a little presumptuous and maybe being a little ungrateful for what I have. So maybe a similar answer to the time machine. I guess that's a little bit of a boring answer for you.
No, that's a beautiful response. That just tells you how grounded and how humble you are, Alan. You know, it means a lot to people, but that's beautiful. Thank you, Alan. So what's something that you have tried that you will never, ever try again?
Oh, it's got to be something like spicy food or things like that. I don't have much tolerance there. And I've been egged on to try certain things that, honestly, I don't even remember what they were, but... that's not for me.
It's so interesting. Yes. So what are your favorite food? What's your favorite food?
I have a couple favorites. Arroz con pollo is chicken and rice, kind of a Cuban style chicken and rice that my mother makes, that my wife has picked up making as well, quite well. Another one is flan, which is another Cuban dessert. So my parents were born in Cuba, so I have a couple of favorites from that culture. And then everybody loves pizza.
God, dear, totally. But if you are asked to cook food for a special guest, what food will you cook for someone?
I don't have a whole lot of skills in that area. I do barbecue, so maybe I would have to resort to some barbecue recipes. If I had some actual culinary skills, maybe I would actually try to make arroz con pollo. I've never actually tried to execute that one.
It's in your blood, Alan. It'll come out. It'll come out naturally for you. Do try that. So if you were a professional wrestler, what would your ring name be and why?
Oh my goodness, a professional wrestler. I am having trouble picturing that, and I'm pretty sure everybody else I know would have trouble picturing me as a professional wrestler. I think it would be something outrageous. Killer or something like that, that, you know, just would totally not fit me at all. But just something, I guess all the professional wrestlers have outrageous names. So
totally, yeah.
I'll leave it at that one.
Yes, killer sounds amazing. So what was your best subject in school?
I went into into engineering for my education. So my best subjects were typically in the math and sciences, although my favorite subject in high school was auto power. So it was an automotive technology class. where, you know, we learned about all the subsystems of a car and how cars work. And there were actually cars in a lot where we were able to do things to work on the cars. You know, simple things like rotating tires or changing oil to actually working on specific things, carburetors and spark plugs and distributors and things like that in the engine, back when cars used to have carburetors. You know, I felt like that was really the greatest combination of the, you know, a lot of the classroom stuff that you learn that isn't, well, it's difficult to see how it's practical when you're in school, with actually doing hands-on things. And that's really been my passion, to make things hands-on and, you know, put things into practice. So yeah, I think the classes that came easiest to me were probably around math, but the, you know, the most interesting ones were, you know, that auto power class.
If I ask a reference from your children about Daddy Alan Bremen, what do you think they will tell about you?
What would they tell? I don't know. I think you'd have to ask them. I think a lot of what I've shared with you, a lot of those characteristics, I think they'd echo a lot of that. I've tried to involve them in projects around the house, and partially to, you know, some bonding time with them, but partially to pass on a couple of skills. And I think they'd probably talk about some of that stuff and some of the maybe more practical or useful things that they've learned from me.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, Alan. So who are the people who have been the most influential in your life and career?
I guess in life, my parents, maybe everybody would have that answer. You know, that they've really, you know, set me up well in life in terms of providing for me and passing on a work ethic and really giving me opportunities and flexibility to pursue what I wanted to pursue. And then I think maybe from a professional standpoint, I've had a number of good bosses / professors that have really helped me along. And I think it's been similar, where people have, it's a combination of teaching and giving flexibility to explore and do things that are interesting to me, that has really helped me grow. So at UCLA or UC Santa Barbara, a couple of professors that I worked for had that. And then even more, most recently, working with AJ Patel at SMA and at Monitor before that, you know, just the combination of teaching and giving opportunities to kind of explore and do things that are most interesting to me, and really allowing me to pursue things and work on things that were, I thought they were interesting and allowed me to kind of explore the curiosity, has helped me to grow. Kind of those sets of people.
Definitely, Alan, there's a lot of abundance in your life. You're so blessed. So what have you observed lately in this COVID environment that reminded you that people are kind?
I feel like there's a lot of genuine care for others. People are wearing masks and you know, nobody really knows what the right answer is for COVID, but people have been generally conscientious about everybody being in tough circumstances and trying to, you know, make their way as well as help others. You know, I think that's, COVID has really accentuated it, but, you know, you kind of see it in other times too, where people will do special little things for others. We had a circumstance recently where my wife underwent a minor medical procedure, and some of our friends really stepped up and provided meals for us, so that way we didn't have to worry about any of that stuff. And you know, we were able to really focus on our family and just getting through, and you know, just that those little bits of kindness really give you a reinforcement that there's good out there.
100%, 100%, Alan. So who's the kindest person you know?
Probably my wife. She's one of those people who is just really friendly and caring to others, and really extends herself to help others out, particularly in their times of need. I just kind of see it over and over, and you know, especially as everybody is maybe a little bit insular or focused on their own circumstances and their own, you know, crazy busy lives. She'll take steps to, you know, help others in big and small ways that, you know, just constantly impresses me.
That's the best answer, Alan. If you didn't say that answer, I would be concerned. But good response. Good response. So what's one kind or thoughtful thing someone did to you recently?
Well, I talked a little bit about how people have brought us meals. That was a really nice one. You know, I think that's really the one that really sticks out in my mind as a recent example. And, you know, we've been lucky that we haven't really needed that much. And so that one really stands out.
Perfect. So what's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
That's an interesting one. I think that a lot of times, and I had this too, you have a certain model in your mind around how your life is going to unfold and the direction you want to go. And I guess I wish I knew that life's not that deterministic, that you're not going to really be able to predict what direction it's going to go. Mm. That's not to say that you should just kind of give up and do whatever. It's good to have a plan and it's good to work towards things, but I think it's important to have a fair bit of flexibility in that plan and recognize that, you know, yes, you're working towards something and it may or may not happen. But you know, you shouldn't stop working or striving towards something just because it may or may not happen. But you should have this openness to new or different opportunities or changes in direction that will, you know, might throw you for a loop. But you know, it's all good, and it's, you know, there's as long as you're pushing in the right direction, you'll end up in good places. But I think, just had I known that it was going to be a lot less deterministic and predictable, I think I maybe would have made a couple of different decisions and probably been a little bit more comfortable with some of the episodes of uncertainty that I went through.
Totally, Alan. That's great advice. Brilliant advice. So, Alan, successful career, you know, engineer all the way up to now doing strategy at a very senior level. What's next for you, Alan? What are you looking forward to in the future?
I don't think I'm looking for anything different at this point. I'm pretty happy where I am. I enjoy the work that we're doing. The kinds of client engagements that we have and the clients that we have are all interesting. And, you know, I guess one of the things I've loved about consulting is just the variety of the projects and being able to enter very different spaces, from space systems to missile defense to ground vehicles to healthcare to IT systems. It's really been all over the place, and I've really enjoyed that diversity. And so, you know, I'm just kind of looking for more of the same, meaning, you know, more variety and more opportunities to engage in these sorts of client challenges and helping clients work through them.
That's amazing, Alan. Definitely it will work perfectly fine for you. Alan, is there any part of your life or career, or is there anything else you would like to share in the last minute or two before we close the podcast?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. I really appreciate the conversation, Bhaskar, and this has been a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Alan. So thank you, Alan. As always, wish you all the success and good health and happiness to you and your family and all your SMA colleagues. Please do continue to inspire everybody around you. Be curious as you always are. Fix things, continue to solve bigger problems, both at home and at elsewhere. Stay safe, stay happy. Thank you so much, Alan. Thanks for joining today.
All right, thanks a lot.
To our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. Please visit batchyscribble.com/podcast to listen to this episode and check out any of our other previously recorded episodes. If you've enjoyed today's interview, don't forget to subscribe, review, and share the Scribble Talk podcast. We hope you'll check out our next episode where we interview another industry expert and special guest. Until then, it's Ashley Kays,
Bhaskar Sundaram,
signing off.